meeting this way. And I was to the meeting was at 8:30, and I was in a meeting with another group beforehand, so that's why I'm coming in late. But I'm really very sorry and apologetic, especially when I realize how close and confined you all seem to be down here. Last night I spoke over at St. Boniface, and every time I've come to San Francisco, I've spoken over there, and I always feel very much at home there. I feel at home because, for one thing, I know that right around the corner they're dispensing food every day to everybody who comes, no questions asked. All you do is to walk down and fill up your tray. And also I know that they have a little farm started where some of the men are working, where they hope to raise more food for the all who come. And this very unquestioning practice of feeding the hungry is something that certainly is very dear to our hearts. We recognize, of course, that one of the temptations was to turn stones into bread. And we're not just thinking in terms of an earthly utopia. We're not thinking just in terms of man's physical needs and all this work that the Catholic worker has been engaged in. Certainly when we think of the works of mercy, we're trying to express our love for God and for our brother in these very simple and elemental terms, and in the ways which have been laid down for us, these very simple ways of the works of mercy. And I tried to bring out last night the fact that the works of mercy are in the long run anything but simple when you get started to practice them. I think that at the very first there was always controversy about voluntary poverty and a great misunderstanding what we were talking about when we talked about voluntary poverty. I think we stressed it first of all because Peter Morin always exemplified to us such a great Franciscan ideal of poverty. And he himself lived so close to the poor on the skid rows and the Boweries and in these lodging houses, traveling by bus everywhere, living from day to day, going where he was invited, traveling around the country, and traveling and speaking wherever he was invited to speak, and speaking even on buses. I know sometimes it was embarrassing for us to travel with him. He liked to take somebody along with him to travel, but if he had a good listener, he liked to sit on the back seat of the bus, then carry on a loud conversation so that all the bus could hear. A discussion. You have no more chairs, huh?
You can have these. I'll sit down.
Too bad you have another speaker here, too. Coming back from Mexico, I was very happy to hear a woman to whom I had given a copy of the Catholic Worker reading aloud from Peter's essays on this bus coming from Mexico City to El Paso, reading aloud from his little essays and laughing with real joy at what she read. And I thought, what a great appeal, what a great attraction Peter Morin's ideas do have for people. And how simple and how fundamental are all these things that he stressed. Voluntary poverty, works of mercy, houses of hospitality, and farming communes. Those were the things that we started to do and the things that we're still doing now, both back in New York and in different parts of the country. Donald McDonald, in a recent column of his, I was happy to see it up in Vancouver when I was up there, had an interview with Ammon Hennessy. And the interview ran something like this. Here is one lone man fighting the hydrogen bomb. One lone man. And then it goes ahead and gives his background that he is one of the editors of the Catholic Worker, and he is living in the one lone house of hospitality which is left in the United States back there in New York. And I object to this very strongly. There are other houses of hospitality beside the one in New York. There's the house in Detroit. There's two houses in Detroit. There's a farm outside of Cleveland, which is a house of hospitality. There's a house in two houses in Chicago. There's a house in Rochester. These are the houses that are directly Catholic worker houses. And then there are individual houses of hospitality in different parts of the country, where people who were not involved in the kind of struggle we are in relation to war and peace and man and the state are very simply and quietly practicing the works of mercy and taking in the needy. Up in Portland, Oregon, there is the Blanchet House of Hospitality, which is a diocesan house. And that house was started by a group of students from Portland University. Most of our houses were started by young men and by groups of students. And in this house of hospitality, they serve about 1,300 meals the day that I was there, 1,353, I think it was. They serve all of these men. And one of the remarkable things about that house is that they've done such a very good public relations job. The young men from Portland University, who were students when they started the work and have now become ordinary businessmen, men who live and work and raise their families in Portland, these men have quietly overcome the antagonism that there is to this type of work. And I often stress the fact that there is antagonism. You get always the questions, are these men rehabilitated? Or would these men work if they had the chance? Or do you get any gratitude from these men? And so on and so forth. And even here in San Francisco, people will point out all the bottles and doorways as though to indicate that all these men who are eating at the Franciscan Church are meanwhile spending their substance on riotous living and indulging in the bottle and then going over there and eating. And these are the kind of arguments always used against the works of mercy. The work in Portland has continued now for quite a number of years. I think it's 8 years. And over again, these thousands have been fed. The fact that there is such unemployment, the fact that there is the problem of the aging, the problem of the disabled, the problem of the mentally unfit, the problem of technological unemployment, all this problem is still with us. It's with us in every city. It's in every great city, the problem of poverty. And we don't like to admit it. We like to hide it. We like to sweep the poor under the rug, you might say, get them out of sight. I know that some friends of ours tried to start a house of hospitality in Mobile, and the Chamber of Commerce and all the civic associations did everything possible they could to squelch it. They did not want the poor attracted to their city. They wanted to move them along. They wanted to send them on their way. They didn't want to draw attention to the fact that there was this poverty, this destitution, and if it kept coming to light, well then, of course, the idea was that it was the fault of the very people concerned. You can't do anything with them. In the last issue of Marinole magazine, there's a story about that a prince told of a great banquet that was given. At this banquet, plentiful food was spread out on the table, a tremendous amount of food, and then all the guests were given such long chopsticks that they couldn't possibly eat the food in front of them. And so they sat there starving to death because they couldn't eat their food with their enormously long chopsticks. So someone pointed out to them that if each man would feed his neighbor across the table, they would all be able to get something to eat. So everybody started feeding his neighbor back and forth across the table. And so everybody laughed over this lesson. They all enjoyed their meal, and they got the point. If you start feeding others, if you start taking care of each other, men will be fed. And this type of thing, this type of work of mercy, as I say, has always been still a matter of controversy around the country. Over and over again, people will say, where are the poor? We have full employment. A man can always get work if he wants work, and so on. So that houses of hospitality are still necessary. I read not long ago a book by Orwell called Down and Out in Paris and London. Somebody said once that the reason he committed himself to this life and became a down-and-outer in Paris and London, washing dishes, usually the lowest kind of occupation, the kind of a job men get when they can get nothing else and have no references of any kind. The reason he took this job was because as an officer, or a police officer of some kind down in India, he had beaten a native. And in a sense of terrible regret, in a sense of penance, he went ahead and devoted himself to this life of the down and out for a year or so. And he wrote this book, which is quite an extraordinary account of men's life, working in resorts and working in hotels and in restaurants and so on, and washing dishes and doing the most menial kind of labor, unskilled work. And he describes their life, which is a terrible one, and describes their destitution, describes their dissipation, describes their going from place to place, and the kind of flop houses that are offered them, and so on. And then in the end, in his last chapters, he talks about solutions, and he talks about houses of hospitality, places where men can go ahead and share with each other, and by mutual aid, take care of each other, and pieces of land, places where men can gather in rural areas and raise food, build up centers of mutual aid. It was very interesting to me to read this because the whole thing was written from the natural point of view, not from the supernatural, from the humanitarian point of view, as a matter of an aid to a problem, some way of solving the problem. Our House of Hospitality in New York, you know, has been passing through various vicissitudes. Someone said once, he talked about our life in miracles. That was when I was writing my book, The Long Loneliness, about 8 to 10 years ago. They said, well, are you writing about your life in miracles? And well, when it comes down to a House of Hospitality, it sounds very much like a life in miracles, because in these last years, we've had a number of vicissitudes. The book ends in 1949, and Arthur Sheehan's book about Peter Morin. Arthur Sheehan is one of the editors of the Catholic Worker, and he wrote a book about Peter Morin and his life in France, his life as a peasant, his life as a teacher in Paris, his life as a migrant worker in the United States, and as a teacher of the whole Catholic Worker movement. And his story also ends in 1949. And many people have written in to say, what has been happening since 1949? Well, I was here in 52 and went back, and we were left in peace and quiet for a year or so. And there are the usual changes around the House of Hospitality. People come and go. Tom Sullivan, in whose house the Catholic Worker, the name, who had the deed of the house. We're not incorporated, you know. We're a group of individuals. We're a group of people editing a paper and committed to the personal practice. Peter Morin always emphasized the personal practice of the works of mercy. So we're not incorporated, and when we own a piece of property, we have to put it in the name of some individual. And you go around a house like ours and say, well, who will have this property in their name? And everybody wants to duck out of it. Tom Sullivan had the property in his name. He was willing to take the responsibility. The farm was in his name. The house on Christie Street was his name, was in his name. Well, suddenly he got a yen to go off and join the Trappists, so off he went. And nobody around the place would take the responsibility of having the property in their name. Tom was a wonderful manager. He was, he used to say, I'm no pacifist. He served in the Pacific. He looked strong and sturdy, and if a guest were obstreperous, why, he could look sternly at him and tell him to go, and the guest would go. There was never any violence around the work. I never saw anybody being given the bum's rush, but Tom was a good manager of the place. We had order. It was a home in which a group of almost 60 people lived. The house was well run. Everybody did his share and portion of the work. One time recently somebody said, we have no bosses around here, we're a group working together. For Tom Sullivan, the authority that he had was one which was accepted by the men. I mean, nobody can have any authority unless they earn it or deserve it. And Tom was a good leader, and we certainly hated to see him go. And the property was deeded over to me. Well, within a few short months, the blow fell. Suddenly, I received a summons from the building department. We had moved into this house in 1950, and there wasn't a single violation against it. There was no difficulty whatever. We moved in. We built up our work. Everything was going along smoothly. We'd had one fire. We'd had a fire on the upper floor of the building, and one man later died of asthma, a man who was burned in the fire. And so that was put down to our account as a fatal fire. That had happened 2 years before Tom's leaving the work. So when I got this summons and was brought into court, the building department said, here are 11 violations against this house. And another building inspector said, and there was a fatal fire in this place 2 years ago, and here are 11 violations. This place was probably full of violations, by the way. One of the violations would be the number of people here. Another violation would be the wiring, perhaps, sir. Another violation would be exit signs over the door, written out, E-X-I-T. And another violation would be not having a light over the exit sign, and so on. And these 11 violations were all listed, and the judge looked sternly at me and said, $500 fine as a slum landlord. Well, this was my first appearance ever in court. Because of a building violation. I'd been in court with the fellow who put out the garbage cans, who got a summons for leaving the lid off of them, and everybody got fined. Hundreds of people got fined, $2 each, for leaving the lids off their garbage can. He just appeared with a multitude of others. It was just a matter of routine, and when I answered these summons, I thought it would be explained to me what our violations were, and I would be told what needed to be done. But instead of all it was $500 fine as a slum landlord. Well, my first instinct was to say, all right, I won't pay the $500. I'll go to jail. Then the building inspector said, we have a vacate notice on this place. And I thought, well, if I go to jail, all our women's house. Two floors of the place were for women. The rest of the house was for men. So I decided I'd better stay out of jail and try to do something about the vacate notice. So the judge, looking at my consternation, the lawyer, the woman lawyer with me, said, try to explain that this was a charitable institution. And the judge said, all the worse for her. These poor people haven't any place else to go, and they've got to stay there. So I was all doubly guilty for taking care of the poor, for they were forced to be there. So he did relent a little, and he put the fine down to $250 and said he would give me until Friday to pay it. So I went home, and I was sitting at my desk in the office wondering what to do next. I called up some people and told them to start looking for a place for us to move to. The vacate notice had arrived, big long white sheet. We took and put little holes in it and tied a string in it and hung it around the neck of St. Joseph. Well, I was sitting there waiting to think of who else to telephone, see if there was an empty apartment, an empty building, empty something or other. And the telephone bell rang, and the man on the phone was a reporter from the New York Times. And he said, I just wanted to call you up about a little matter of fact. He said, I teach up at Columbia University, a class in journalism, and one of my students got up today and said that the Catholic Worker refused money from the Ford Foundation. He said, is this true? So I said, well, it was a few years before, Milton Mayer had written to us and said, if you will put in an application for, say, $15,000 to $25,000 a year for the next 10 years, and describe the kind of work we're doing of housing, hospitality, and farming community. an occasion of great mirth around the office, the idea of Ruth and the Ford Foundation. First of all, everybody began talking about this being stolen money. After all, this immense sum of money had been done from the toil of all the auto workers. One of our best friends in Detroit had been the first president of the first Ford local, and he had died at the age of 45 of inflammatory rheumatism because he was working on cement floors at the graveyard shift, 11 o'clock at night until 7 in the morning. He'd had the hose turned on him for trying to organize Ford's plants. He had been fired again and again. He'd been laid off in unemployment. He had been beaten up for his attempts at organizing. His family, his children, his wife, he had been on leave. And the very prospect of the we were filled with class war attitudes over that. Anything but specific. And then, of course, the very practical consideration of the fact that we were all thanks to voluntary colleges. We don't have dollars in college. Look at the kind of folks that we get. One person who looks after the circulation department, one fellow comes in who can go ahead and cook a bowl of stew. And other fellows come in who can wait on table. And here you have all these people around the place voluntarily working together to build up a center of mutual aid and consider themselves a group of men with no bosses, even wanting to say, fire the bosses, find some work that you can do and do it. That's why it depends on the boss. There's plenty of work to do. You might be able to do it as mutual aid. Of the voluntary association of men working together for the common good. It would not have a very good effect on all these volunteers to think that a chunk of money like that was coming in from the Ford Foundation. Somebody else pointed out that it was a very small sum. Very small sum to sell our soul for this trifling amount. After all, we began adding up all the money that had to be spent for the bread line, for the thousands of people that came to us, the thousands of meals, rather, that were served. Our bread line now isn't more than about 250 at a meal. So, naturally, we just did nothing about this. We turned down the offer, thanking Milton Mayer very much. And it was all very informally given, and certainly I didn't think that there was any news value in this. I explained this to the reporter over the phone, and he said, well, that was a valid enough offer. He knew Milton Mayer, and he knew the foundation, and so on. But I said, now today we're in real trouble. We have just gotten a vacate notice, and I've just been signed as a self-landlord. So this good friend, Will Listener, we'd never met him before, but he has always been one of the reporters on the New York Times that signs this stuff. He came right on down, and he wrote a story about this eviction notice and wrote a story about the fine. And, of course, it puts the city officials in that kind of a position where they call up bitterly and say, when they saw the story in the New York Times, there was a story with the headline at the top, the one-column headline, saying, Dorothy Day fined $250 as slum landlord. Well, the judge told me about that. We can do about this. The building department called up and they complained and they said, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. If there's a fire and we haven't been very strict in enforcing regulations, we get into trouble. And where we do enforce them, as in this case, we get into trouble too. They felt great fear. So the next morning, I was going out of the place. After the bread line is over, we usually know that this church is for the men to get clothes. There was quite a crowd out in front, as usual. One man came up from This is for the fine. And I thanked him and didn't look at it, and didn't look at him, as a matter of fact, either, because I was in a hurry. I had to get all the way up to the Bronx to this court. I was on my way to the subway. So I went down the subway and opened up the paper, and here was a check for $250, signed by Auden, the poet. Well, this was a complete surprise. I hadn't even looked at the man. I'd met him a couple of times before, casually at meetings, but I didn't really know him at all. And I was completely overwhelmed, of course, at this generosity. I had thought it was one of the men waiting for a suit of clothes, waiting for a pair of shoes. And here I had been presented with this amount of money to cover the fine. Well, I went up there, and feeling cheered somewhat by this, I went up there and ran into another reporter. And I told him about this wonderful gift. So right away, of course, he used it in the Associated Press, and they sent it out, the story of how this poet came to the rescue of this pauper. There were stories in Time, stories in the nice romantic touch, you know. So this started off our rescue from the situation. The judge, meanwhile, we came up before the judge again, and there were three building inspectors, and then the judge. He said very kindly, he said, "You know, you'll have to go ahead and put in about $28,000 worth of repairs in that building." So the building inspectors say that you have to have a sprinkler system throughout. He said, "It's not compulsory this year. It's only in the hallways this year, but next year it's going to be in all the rooms, and so you might as well have it all done now. And then you'll have to have steel self-closing doors." They cost $150 a piece, by the way. And all kinds of other $25,000 worth of repairs. He said, "Now I'll give you 1 month so that you can get these repairs made. Do you think you can raise the $25,000, $28,000? So I said, "Well, I can't raise the money, but St. Joseph can raise it." And he looked at me scornfully and said, "Well, who's St. Joseph?" And the building inspector said, "He's the saint we have to pray to when we come before you, Judge Nichols." The judge went on to say, "Does this do you any good?" And they shook their heads and said, "No, it hadn't done them any good." So they postponed the case for 30 days, and they said, "If you don't get the repairs done, the eviction notice goes into effect. And meanwhile, the fine will be a suspended sentence." Well, you know, in all my excitement, I forgot that business of the fine. And it wasn't until a year or so later that I called up Mr. Auden and offered him back the $250 that had been a suspended sentence. Meanwhile, we just put it into the general fund, you know, as the first offering towards the building up of the house again. Of course, he refused it. But we went busy on the job. We began calling up the contractors and the plumbers and steam fitters and everything else under the sun to get the work done. And meanwhile, just through this newspaper account, money began to pour into the place. We got money from the New York State Legislature. They took up a collection. It might have been $50, $75, I don't know how much. And various trade unions, the steel workers, McDonald, and some of his office force sent a donation. The Amalgamated Clothing Workers Joint Board sent a donation. Various other unions. An actress up on Broadway sent a donation. And some friends from Columbia University that I had known way back when I was 18 years old, who were now lawyers down on Wall Street, they took up a collection in their office and sent it. And little by little, the money came in, and the work was done. At the end of the month, we had $28,000 exactly the amount that they said it would take. Only the joke was that the repairs only cost $24,000, and we had $4,000 left over. That was the amount of our mortgage. We paid off the mortgage. So the whole thing worked out extremely well. When I went before the judge again, he said, "You owe me a great deal of thanks," he said. He said, "I saw to it that you got a lot of publicity and you've got all this work done now." So he didn't think of thanking St. Joseph. and I didn't say to him, you don't say these things to judges, that 10 years before we had raised $30,000 to buy the house with absolutely no publicity whatever, and just through the generosity of friends and all the people to whom we owed bills who told us to postpone paying them. It had taken us almost another 5 years to catch up, but we had been able to buy the house we were in. So all this work was done. And 2 years passed, and the city came and said, we need this property because we're putting a subway underneath. And so all this work was done for nothing. And the house was torn down, we were all evicted, and now we are scattered. We have rented a loft, which I would say is much longer than this basement here. It's quite a bit wider, and it's 180 to 200 feet long. It's been divided up into